Take a network break. Grab a coffee and a virtual donut and join us for our weekly review of tech news. We got stories on Nutanix, Amazon, Cisco, and more. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow, and we've got a special guest today, John Free, Senior Analyst at More Insight Strategy. And we're going to dive into the news just after this message from our sponsor, ThousandEyes. ThousandEyes delivers visibility into every network your organization relies on, from your data center to the cloud. You can quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of network issues wherever they occur, and then share your insights with your vendors and customers. Sign up for an account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers to monitor three locations for free and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt. Jumping into the news, Nutanix, they're adding some networking features to their hyperconvergence platform. First is a new visualization capability. That means its Prism Management Console is going to be updated to show how virtual machines are connected to virtual switches and the physical network. I think the idea here is to make it easier for admins to spot things like a misconfigured VLAN, a port failure, packet drops that might be affecting performance. They're also announcing a future release for its Acropolis hypervisor. It's going to have stateful distributed firewall capabilities. They're calling this the Acropolis Micro Segmentation Service, AMS. So administrators will be able to set up and enforce policies, do things like isolate virtual machines.
This should be no surprise to anybody that today what we have is a software-only virtual networking service is not all that difficult to do. What we imagined 5 years ago when Nasira came out and started talking about software-based overlays, and we all went, no, that couldn't possibly work. Now it's sort of proven that software is easy to do, straightforward. So it should be no surprise that Nutanix is, A, able to do this, and B, two, that they're doing it, right? Because in a hyperconverged platform, you want to buy an all-in-one package. You don't want to go to Nutanix and then suddenly have to work out your networking separately from Nutanix. Now, not all Nutanix customers want that, I'm sure, but I think majority of them will. And so Nutanix has gone out, written up some software so that they can now do that. I think the third thing that's happening here is that I've said before that the hyperconvergence also means that networking and servers and virtualization are all coming into one glob, and you'll buy it a rack at a time or a half rack at a time, and you won't have control over your physical network for much longer. This is another step in that direction. And finally, and not unimportantly, when you look at the stacks that are being built like Azure Private Cloud, those are being sold by HPE and Dell. They actually come with the switches in the rack. So the whole networking piece, when you go and buy an Azure Private Cloud, is determined when you go and buy your HPE or Dell solution. And Cisco will probably get a leg in, but they're not an approved supplier with Microsoft's Azure Private Cloud at this point in time. So you will start to get HPE networking and Dell networking. If you buy Azure Private Cloud, you have no choice. And Nutanix, I think, is responding to that competitive pressure. Never one thing, more than one. So yeah, no surprise.
Yeah, I think it's a really good idea. And I think as you look at what Nutanix has done from a hyperconverged standpoint, they're approaching it much more from a software perspective. If you still look at what the OEMs are doing, they're doing hyperconverged, but it's really more like hyper silos because there's still a little bit too much of the productization in there and less of the focus on software. So I think Nutanix has got a pretty good advantage in this area.
Well, they compete directly with VMware in a lot of ways. And so they have to do that. It's much more sense to come up with a software only solution because NSX is pure software. And of course, the second thing is it's very easy to do software compared to trying to do a hardware based SDN like Cisco ACI or Big Switch. Those things take, years to iterate and make stable and reliable and get, although coming up to it now, it'd be a lot easier because the hardware is far improved, but much easier just to get some software, use a basic switch. And it's not like the data center needs really complex hardware anymore because you just don't have that many servers, right? Like a good Nutanix system can easily support 200 to 700 VMs in a single rack.
Right. And the issue with the Nutanix and all of that is the more you can integrate the networking into what you're doing, networking is that big ball of cables that comes out of the back of everything and creates all the problems. And the more virtual you can make that, the more streamlined you can make it, because blades were great. But as soon as people started deploying blades, everything got really ugly on the back end.
Yeah. So operationally then, does this mean more networking type of functions like setting up firewall policies will fall to just sort of your general administrator or your server administrator? Or is it going to be, hey, networking folks come, toggle into this console and help us out or use these templates that the networking folks have set up?
It'll be a little bit of both, I think. I think in the early days, this is just an SDN piece. So that is, you'll be able to, the announcement on Nutanix's website talks about service change. So they'll be able to build networks that go between VMs, and those VMs can be virtual firewalls. So if it's a Palo Alto is the one they specifically call out in the documentation, it won't automate the configuration of the firewall rules. So you'll still have your old stuff. But as time goes by, I suspect that Nutanix will, like all the SDM people, start to instantiate, get closer and closer to integrating the firewalls into the orchestration system. So in the same way that you've seen NSX add firewalls to the virtual switch, firewalling features to the virtual switch and a whole bunch of features into the virtual switch, I think you'll see Nutanix do that too. In the same way that ACI has gotten into partnerships with F5 and Checkpoint and, you know, Palo Alto and any number of other people to try and make ACI relevant, they've made those VMs, you know, easier to install and easier to orchestrate. And it's only one more step until you actually start configuring them as part of the template. So when ACI acquired Clicker and what Brocade is doing with StackStorm, is the idea is that you should be able to use the orchestration system to configure a wide range of tools, not just VLANs and VMs and vSwitches. It's also firewalls and IDSs. If you deploy a service, everything should be templated and easily to configure. So I think iterating forward, this pathway is, you know, laid out, it's been paved out, and the highway has been cut through. So all Nutanix has to do is drive down it, copy the features from other people and implement them, and away they go.
And you hit the nail on the head with the wide range of services statement, because that's what really is going to work, is not having Palo Alto on board, but having 20 or 30 different options on board. Then service chaining makes sense. Today it's service chaining one or two functions, yeah. And that's not as interesting.
Yeah, and that comes down to, you know, we've already got F5 partnering with everybody left, right, and center. You know, Cisco was the first partner that they came up with for their virtuals and building APIs. But now F5 is partnering with everybody in the SDN space, NewArch, PlumGrid, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's like, you know, throw your keys in the bucket and let's have a party. Of course I'm your partner. I'm your only partner for our relationship. And I've got plenty of other partners too. And so we're seeing a lot of that come down. And but for Nutanix, it's not like Nutanix has to invent something here or create a market, or they're not going to lead with networking. The thing that Nutanix really got right in its first hyperconvergence play was the storage. It was the first to get a distributed storage engine together. And that is the hardest part of a hyperconverged. Building a software-defined networking engine for the data center is kind of trivial because the standards all exist. We all know what there's plenty of open source SDN code that you could adapt or, you know, hook off to. And you know exactly what your customer wants because we've had 5 years of SDN to define what it is that we need to achieve. So it shouldn't be hard for Nutanix to hit the side of that barn.
All right. Well, the network visualization feature is going to be rolled out in January of next year, 2017. Other features will be available at a later date. Let's move on. Amazon, they've announced a price drop on a few EC2 instance types. Price decreases will go into effect December 1st. They're cutting prices by 5 or 10% for the Eastern U.S., depending on the instance type, and up to 25% in Asia Pacific. According to Amazon, this is the 53rd price reduction.
Yeah, so I've pointed out several times this year that Amazon hasn't had a single price reduction except for a couple in Q1. So this, by my reckoning, is the only discount we've had in the second half of this year. And yes, it is their 53rd, but at this time last year, it was their 48th. So not exactly something to get, you know, for those of you who are only hearing price reduction, the reality is that there just hasn't been that many price reductions this year. And the profit margins that Amazon is spinning off, which are absolutely enormous. We saw some discussion earlier this year. I can't remember the exact numbers. But, you know, AWS is making buku profits and handing out a tiny, tiny reduction like this on a very limited set of corner case instances isn't actually all that big a deal.
To me, the 53rd price reduction, the scary part about that is not only are they counting, but somebody is probably being measured on this. And so when you hear people talk about AWS driving down the price and it becoming the race to the lowest price, that's kind of an indicator of that. Also, if you look at where the instances, where the discounts are coming, it's different by region, right, which may point to them maybe either overbuilding out infrastructure or under-anticipating or over-anticipating some things in different areas and trying to basically load balance the different instances that they have.
Yeah, so Duction, so a C4 instance, which is a pretty big instance, 5% in US East and 20% in Asia Pacific in Mumbai and Singapore, right? So maybe Asia Pacific hasn't been quite so friendly to AWS.
Yeah.
Whereas demand in – now, keep in mind also that there's a lot more demand to put assets in US East because there's a lot more people there compared to, say, what's happening in Asia Pacific. There's just not that many consumers. And historically, Amazon has been weak in the Asian markets because it's an American company. So, again, you know, let's just – if they want to drop the price by 25% in a specific region to try and fill up some of the, as you say, as John says, fill up some of capacity that isn't being used, you know, well, I guess that's okay then, John. But again, it's not like AWS is hurting to bring you these discounts.
Yeah, not anymore. No, you know, no. They've stopped the bleeding. Because
we've seen several articles lately about how good Google is. Like Google will actually give you a discount. So if you go and book instances and you don't burn the CPU, you don't burn the storage, if you buy a reserved instance or if you're doing something, at the end of the month, Google will send you a refund and say, you committed to pay this much, but actually you didn't spend it, so we're going to give you that money back.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which is a sign that they're behind, I think.
I think AWS or Amazon is a company that likes to take your money, right? Most of its profits get plowed back into growing the size of the business, but – you know, Amazon has a lot more in common with Cisco and EMC and, you know, IBM than it does with, you know, Google sort of saying, you know, being nice to its customers, shall we say.
Well, if you looked at the way Jeff Bezos ran the business before he even got into computing, he was willing to run losses for years and years and years until he could dominate an industry like the bookselling market. So not a surprise that he could bring that to computing as well.
Yeah. The speculation is that AWS is the cash cow that funds the losses. So he doesn't make a loss across the whole Amazon business, but it's because AWS is the cash flow that funds the losses in the other parts now.
Right.
So why discount if you're winning?
Well, of course. Yeah, you don't need to. That's how the game is played. All right, sticking with cloud, Google and Intel have announced a quote-unquote strategic alliance to get more enterprises to buy into cloud computing. According to a Google blog about the partnership, the alliance is going to focus on four cloudy buzzwords: Kubernetes, machine learning, IoT, and security. In particular, the partnership is trying to boost virtual network performance and resource prioritization in Kubernetes and develop a secure way to connect Intel's IoT edge devices to Google Cloud.
I think, you know, the best part about this is that the press release actually says the Google Cloud team is excited to announce. Not often you see the word excited in a press release, right? Not any used to. It really sticks out, like excited. It's like someone at high school wrote this. It's like, is there no grown-ups at Google sometimes?
We're besties, bestie friends forever.
Yeah, I'm so excited, buddies. I don't know what to make of this. Intel's everywhere, right? And If Intel and Google have got a partnership going on, this must be one of about like 152,639 or something, because they've been collaborating on hardware and CPU designs and server motherboards and, you know, DPDK and blah, 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 blah. So to suddenly work with Intel around Kubernetes and machine learning and Internet of Things and security doesn't, I don't know, that doesn't sound unique to me. That just sounds like, duh.
Yeah.
and if you look at what they're trying to do and what they say, they're trying to get businesses to adopt cloud computing, Kubernetes, machine learning, IoT, and security. Three out of the four are what I would call second-level problems that you've got to get cloudified first before you start running down the path with worrying about orchestration or machine learning or IoT. And security is typically the biggest barrier that most people throw up for why I don't want to head down the cloud path. So it doesn't seem like they're going, if you're trying to get people to go do cloud, it seems like they're picking the wrong targets.
Well, what about Intel's hardware security? They've got those SGX extensions in the CPU core, and maybe Google is offering to, you know, put those hardware extensions through to the virtual machine so you can have some enhanced hardware security. Is that what they're saying? And the same thing with ML, you'll get access to the FPGA and a GPU maybe?
Possibly. And I think, you know, everything Intel does, there's a hardware driver behind it somewhere. They never do anything just because it's a great thing to do. I just think if you're going to head down the path of trying to get people thinking about cloud, there's some really low-level block and tackle things like virtualization and deployment that you really ought to be focusing on first, because those are going to be the real impediments to getting people on cloud.
Well, let me say, just respectfully offer a counter argument in that if you are trying to pull
don't
people
do it
into
respectfully, for all goodness right. sake, this is okay. this show. What the hell?
Well, I wouldn't be respectful with you, but we have a guest. I have to be polite. So if I'm going to try to lure people into the cloud, I'm going to put more effort on new applications, and I'm going to try to appeal to the developers. So I'm going to do things like Kubernetes, which is the cool stuff developers are working on, and lure them into the cloud with some nice integrations, as opposed to trying to do that heavy lift and load their premises legacy applications that are going to require, as you're right, a ton of block and tackle. I don't think it's about those. I think it's about whatever new you're developing on. Hey, look at our Google Cloud. Look at how awesome it is. We've got Kubernetes all nice and integrated for you, all you developers. So come start playing around here and build some momentum and then suck the organization in that way.
That's an interesting point.
Well, I mean, if I was building an IoT platform, let's say Packet Pusher suddenly moved into building asset management. So that is monitoring a building and trying to, say, optimize the electricity consumption for your 40-story high-rise, right? Then what I would do is flood the building with sensors. Now, all of a sudden, I've got data everywhere, doors opening and shutting, air conditioning, temperatures. I've got monitors on the electricity system on each floor, so I know how much power is being consumed. I know I got some airflow sensors. So now I've got a bunch of sensors. I need somewhere to store the data. So I put that in the cloud. Now I need systems that are going to receive that data and analyze it. So I use Kubernetes to orchestrate because I'm containers. Now I need to do something with the data. So I apply some machine learning. So they have their TensorFlow. And in this case, it sort of suggests that Google's TensorFlow is going to be accelerated on Intel processors. So yay. So now I can do some machine learning in Google's cloud. And I can now use that to go back to the customer and say, if you did this with your building system, I could cut your bills by 20%. Mm-hmm. Kubernetes doing the orchestration, machine learning doing the data and analytics, IoT. So Intel has a bunch of IoT appliances. I talked about that when I went to the Intel conference earlier this year. And recorded a bunch of shows, and they announced a whole range of little hardware devices for creating those sensors, like little battery-powered and low-cost appliances, visualization engines, so you can actually put cameras, so you can do face recognition of people as they walk past, so you can have automated security. And then once you've got that data, once you've got that processing, somewhere you need security to say, I need to make sure that this data is isolated and it's in the cloud and I have to meet some higher level. And as it says here in the press release, enhancing security integration between Intel hardware and GCP infrastructure will further enterprise security. This to me is a ticker that it's like SGX, because you can now start to crypto your data with hardware crypto in the SGX extensions that Intel's folding into their CPUs in the next year or two. That's how I kind of see it if I'm trying to imagine a use case.
And do you see this as Google thinking about building out a whole service arm around like a machine learning data processing service, or just we have all these capabilities, you come in and wrap it up?
Machine learning is very well suited. Google's cloud is very well suited to machine learning. In that sense, they've caught a jump on AWS. You know, AWS has got serverless, sure. They've got S3, sure. They've got a bunch of stuff, you know, that's really quite cute, quite good. But Google's actually just got this container stuff down pat, and people are saying that it's way ahead. And they own Kubernetes. They can drive Kubernetes in a direction that works for them through their input to it, and they can definitely steer Kubernetes away from what AWS wants it to be. And I think containers is a lot more interesting for customers than serverless. So for small beer, mom and pop shops, or, you know, a bunch of kids who are hanging out in a dorm room hoping to make the next big thing, they're going to love serverless because they're not going to be on the hook for stuff. But really serious companies, they're much likely to play with containers and as an infrastructure because it's portable. I can pull it out of GCE theoretically and run it on a private cloud, or I can move it to Azure, or I can maybe even move it to AWS if I can justify the price. So, you know, I think we're seeing a much more mature cloud market instead of the rah, 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 everything crowds. Got to be cloud. What? It's not a question of which cloud, it's just cloud. There's only one cloud, and thou shalt only consume one cloud. You know, we're seeing a much more nuanced discussion start.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I think the issue that people will have is that cloud portability that they think that you might be thinking is there is not there. And I think once you get launched on a platform, you're probably less likely, even with containers, to move it to another cloud platform. So part of this is, again, Google in that great cloud land grab trying to go establish a beachhead and try to get as much market share before things start to fill up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if you're building a $50 billion company, or, you know, you're dropping a $40 million on developing that back end that I just talked about, mm-hmm. in an IoT platform, you want it to be portable. You don't want to be, you know, beholden to AWS. You don't want to have your foot nailed to the floor or your, you know, as they say, balls in a vice like AWS does to you today.
Yeah. And you're more likely to put those in a vice with Google than you might be with AWS.
Because you, the least you can perceive a way out.
Right.
Yes.
Google, our vice is less tight than AWS.
There you go. That's as good as excited. Do you see what I did there? Do you see what I did?
You brought it right back. Wow. You should
brought it right
go into stand-up.
Around.
Yeah.
I am on
nice.
Fire
Call,
today.
The callback.
I'm on fire.
Woo. All right, let's keep this fire burning. Israeli and Canadian security researchers, they released a paper describing a worm that can target IoT devices. You're talking about IoT. It can spread across a wide geographical area, like a city block or maybe even a whole city, using a Zigbee Wi-Fi network. And they actually demonstrated the worm by exploiting vulnerabilities they discovered in smart light bulbs made by Philips. We'll have a link. You can see videos of them remotely taking over building lights from a car and even a drone. It's really frightening and silly.
This to me is really scary, because as I think about it and I think about hackers and the ability to get into systems, this is one of the areas that I think is least protected for most businesses. Typically, you're going to have an air gap. And I've got a friend that works in this industry that talks about how they set up their networks with a lot of their smart devices, but not everybody follows all the right procedures. And the fact that you can do this with a drone means the attack footprint can be suddenly much larger than the physical perimeter. Think about the fences around every major co-location data center you've seen. What if you can fly a drone up and drop a drone in? There's a lot of potential for mischief there.
What's also interesting is how, I mean, they really went at this hard. They found a way to extract the crypto key that Philips uses to sign and encrypt firmware updates. So, I mean, Philips was trying to do the right things, and they still found a way to get into the system. And the researchers, this is just speculation, but they're saying if we could control a significant number of, say, lighting devices, you know, a whole city, and we just turn them on and turn them off really fast, maybe we could shut down a grid for a while.
You sure could.
Or if I want to rob a bank, you know, all I've got to do is make sure that I can shut down all the lights in the bank,
sure,
cause chaos.
And maybe the alarm system.
Yeah. No, I wouldn't do it in the bank. I'd do it for 10 blocks in any direction around it, cause chaos, and then rob the bank.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I guess there's a few things here. One of them is that, you know, IoT is just not secure. Obviously, we know that. We've seen several evidences of that. And a company like Philips, which theoretically has spent quite a substantial amount of effort into even being secure, still isn't getting it right. For me, it's not so much that it's insecure. That's like a given. Duh. Yeah. You know, sort of thing. The question is, who's banging on Philips' door to help fix this problem? And I'll bet you it's Cisco. So Philips and Cisco have been bum jumping each other for the last 6 months to a year, talking about, you know, partnerships, and, you know, Cisco's going to be – I think you're going to see Philips start to move to a centralized control model instead of the distributed networking model that they've got now. And there's going to be a Cisco device at the middle that's going to be holding the crypto keys and rotating them. And Cisco's going to be sitting there saying, oh, Mr. Philips, we've got the greatest security. You should definitely be buying our stuff and selling it as part of the package. And there'll be a Cisco thing inside of those boxes, or a Cisco gateway that's their IoT platform. That'll be the future. And if it's not Cisco, it'll be somebody else.
It's most likely going to be Cisco, because you've got to cross a wide number of vendors. And I think they have the deepest relationships in that aspect.
Mm, that's right.
Huawei is also very interested in this space. I was at an event of theirs earlier in the summer, and they had a discussion with an elevator company that are putting in sensors in their elevators to do preventative maintenance. And then that information gets fed back through a Huawei device, et cetera, et cetera. So not just Cisco. A lot of people are looking at this.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That's what I said. I know that Philips and Cisco have been having a great time.
Right. They've announced some partnerships, yeah.
Lots and lots of partnerships. Now, whether they actually turn into anything, you know, in billion-dollar companies, the path to nirvana is Byzantine at best. But I bet that that's what's actually happening here is Philips is now looking at its Hughes and going, how do I fix this? And I'm pretty sure the only answer here is that up until now they've run these, like our routers, like a routed network in the internet today. Everyone trusts everybody else, and there's sort of a very loose security model. And they're going like, the only way to fix this is to start having a centralized control point, an SDN, if you like, you know, controller somewhere inside of the infrastructure which owns the lights. So if you actually want to crack the lights, you have to crack the central controller. The lights themselves are reasonably secured down. They have things like rotating crypto keys and things like. How stupid are you to just have one key, right?
That was definitely an issue, yes.
Yeah, yeah, right. and if you have a centralized control point, then the control point becomes the weakness and they have to attack that. And who just so happens to have the software and the SAR hardware and the security chops and a brand name and several billion dollars to be able to turn that into and to negotiate on an equal footing with Philips to make a good message around that.
Mm-hmm. That would be Cisco.
It's not going to be some two-bit startup out of Silicon Valley or Shanghai.
And just to tie this up, the researchers have alerted Philips about the vulnerabilities. They say that Philips has software updates available. So if you're using Philips Smart Hue or Hue lights, you may want to look for a software update. Mm-hmm. All right, let's take a break to talk about our sponsor, ThousandEyes.
Thanks to ThousandEyes for sponsoring the show today. And as your network expands to include cloud services, ISPs, and third-party providers, your visibility diminishes, right? Because it's a huge problem when your traffic starts to run across the internet over multiple providers, multiple networks. You're just running critical applications, and you just don't know what's happening. And that's where ThousandEyes comes in. ThousandEyes gives you visibility into every network your company relies on, your corporate, your network, the internet, your cloud service provider network, and it pulls it all together into one central console. ThousandEyes cloud agents are deployed in locations all across the globe, and their enterprise agents provide additional visibility from within your own network. You literally put those little agents around your network. There's different ways that they can come in. They can be in the router or in boxes outside the router. And these vantage points provide like a really complete understanding of how your network topology looks, what your dependencies and behavior. So if you want to monitor your existing private WAN or even your upcoming SD-WAN, because goodness knows you're going to be deploying that next year, aren't you? ThousandEyes could be a tool that could really help you with that, or as an adjunct to your existing SD-WAN monitoring. So with ThousandEyes, you can piece together multiple layers of network insight, BGP routing, DNS to web server and layer 3 performance, quickly and precisely pinpoint the root cause of problems like faults, DDoS, and route leaks, share data and insights with vendors and customers to resolve problems faster, literally just share a web page that has the problem so that you can go to your carrier and say, you screwed up, fix that. So here's a special offer for you listeners. Sign up for a free account at ThousandEyes.com/packetpushers and choose a free ThousandEyes t-shirt and start seeing your network like you've never seen it before. And they do me a favor. If you do get the t-shirt, take a photo of it and tweet it out. And that's always good fun. The vendors seem to love that a lot. ThousandEyes, network intelligence you can see.
All right. Thanks, ThousandEyes, for being a sponsor. Back to the news. The Register is reporting that HPE is going to outsource a majority of its internal global IT team. The team is going to be moved to CSC, which is a technology services company, which will then sell the IT services back to HPE.
This is not going to go well. There's no way this ends in a happy story. This is a Home Alone all over again, really. There's no way that the press on this is going to be positive, one. And two, every time I've seen an outsourcing agreement of internal IT services, it always ends up with substandard internal IT services. John?
Yeah. And I think the real question is, what does this message say to the market? If your CIO says, hey, we're going to be talking to HPE about you know, some services, or we're going to be talking about bringing in CSC, does this suddenly raise the hackles of everybody in IT that, you know what, these are guys who are outsourcing it, and so that's, if that was their strategy, that's what they're going to recommend for us. So I think strategically, if you're HPE, this makes it harder to sell your services and your business to IT, because they're immediately skeptical of anything that you do.
Didn't HP buy CSC a while ago?
So this is where the deal gets a little bit incestuous. Earlier this year, HP, they did announce that it was merging its enterprise services division. They were going to merge that with CSC. And as part of that merger, HPE shareholders got 50% of this company, and Meg Whitman gets a seat on CSC's board. So it's a little bit like they're keeping it family, but it's still icky.
Yeah, I think also this might be one of these outsourcing deals where you are actually outsourcing to re-engineer your process. So it could be much more of a business process re-engineering exercise rather than a we're going to save money by moving it out. It's certainly a possibility that I've seen this so many times over the years. You've got a team of 1,000 or 2,000 people, and they've got all these bad practices and poor quality staff doing second-rate things, and you just can't see a way to fix the internal problems in a short enough period of time. You can't, like, get them trained or turn over the management or walk people out the door. And sometimes the easiest way is just to outsource everything and then bring it back in a few years' time.
So the Register, they said they saw an internal memo announcing this. And they also said that part of the internal memo was praise for the IT department for such the great job that they did in going through this split of the HP organization and how fantastic they were and got all the applications and all the data centers split out and consolidated and all that stuff, how fantastic this team was. And oh, by the way, guess what? We're outsourcing. I wonder if maybe it's given the relationship with this company, if it's going to be more like HPE's trying to offload some of its liability, the human resource liability of salary and pensions and 401k and healthcare to CSC, but the folks are actually still going to be essentially sitting at the desk they were sitting at yesterday. I have no idea, but just that just popped into my head.
You know, unless another.
Sorry, go ahead, John.
I was going to say another area to look at is They've split HPE and HPI apart into two separate companies, and that happened relatively fast, which you don't see in large IT organizations. Are they spinning off the HPE enterprise side of things, the IS support? Are they pushing that off to CSC, and then is HPI going to do the same thing, and it's a way to not have to basically undo everything that they've done and separate all of that? If they operated out of CSC, can they kind of keep those two together?
Yeah, I can see. I mean, I think there's a business reason behind this, less financial. Maybe CSC is struggling to make a profit, and HPE owns 50% of it, and if it doesn't make a good deal, so maybe they're beefing it up. But as you say, I think it's entirely possible that the split means they've got a very, very, very high headcount stuck there, and the only way that they can get rid of it is to hand it off to somebody as a big chunk instead of downsizing and going through the cost of downsizing, which is substantial when you walk people out the door. You actually have to take one-off costs at substantial whacks. Whereas if you hand people off to CSC and then do a deal like this, CSC might be able to get a bunch of headcount that it can allocate to other projects. Mm-hmm. And people who've actually, you know, do actually have some skills or something to, that are valuable.
All right, well, this is definitely a story we're going to keep an eye on, and wishing everybody in Eternal IT at HPE luck. Moving on, Microsoft, they're joining the Linux Foundation as a platinum member. We talk about the Linux Foundation all the time on the show because they oversee networking-related projects like Open Daylight, OpenSwitch, and Onos. So the question here is, what is Microsoft's interest? I know that sound.
Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear. How the worm turns, right? Microsoft fortifies commitment to open source. Oh my, be still my cynical heart. If you ever wanted a clearest sign that open source has won, that's it right there. I'm done. I'm out. I don't need to say anything, really, surely.
John, any comments?
After that, I'm not sure I should, but I think that the worst kept secret at Microsoft was the fact that so much open source and Linux was driving what's underneath Azure. And, and you know, that's common knowledge in the industry. And I'm always skeptical when I see anybody who is what I would consider a proprietary vendor getting involved in anything open source, because I always think there's another motivation. But to some degree, Microsoft is slowly coming around to the fact that this is not the same world that they grew up in. And you've seen them move away from a licensing model that was all about Windows and Office, and you see them looking at different streams. This is a nod to that reality, but they still obviously have a long way to go.
I guess my take is that if all the major infrastructure, cloud infrastructure that we've seen built out relies heavily on open source, you can't do it proprietary, and Microsoft has acknowledged that. They've also been contributing to foundation projects like Node.js, Open Daylight, and the Open Container Initiative. So now I guess they're just making it official. TechCrunch reports the platinum membership that Microsoft signed up for is close to $500,000, and Microsoft gets a seat on the Linux Foundation board of directors.
$500,000 is like change that fell down the back of the sofa for Microsoft.
Yes.
That's
yes.
Like 10 minutes of Microsoft Office revenue.
Yeah, and when you look at where they really want to make their investments, it's mostly around networking. It's in areas where they don't have products. So they're very happy to work with Open Daylight and OpenSwitch and other places where they don't necessarily have a directly competing product. It'll be interesting to see what happens on more of the database front and things like that.
Right. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I just the turnaround from, you know, we only produce proprietary products that are licensed and sold, and the reality is that, you know, people don't want to use those products on Azure. They have to support containers and Linux and da 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 da. Just couldn't make Windows NT stick.
Yep.
Yep. All right, we're going to, speaking of sticking, stick with Microsoft. Bloomberg, they're reporting that Microsoft is going to link executive bonuses to the company's diversity goals. This comes after 2 years in a row of declines in women employees at the company. At present, women are just over a quarter of Microsoft's workforce, and the number for African-Americans and Hispanic employees is in the single digits. So reportedly, Satya Nadella, the CEO, he's working on a plan to make diversity goals a factor in whether executives get a full bonus.
When women don't want to work at your company, maybe it's not them. So I think this is a good, it's a good view. It's a good step in the right direction. My only fear is that if you make that proclamation and drive it all the way down to the work group managers and make them responsible for it, when you got six people in your work group, trying to change the dynamics becomes very difficult. And you start looking at it as a quota. If you say, look, our senior executives are going to be held accountable to this, you know, people that have 300-400 people in their organization, you can go drive that. But when you drive it down to the individual hiring managers, it becomes a mess. But ultimately, you do have to drive that diversity, because I think when you look across Silicon Valley, every time I sit down and meet with a company, I'm in a room full of old white guys. Right. You know, maybe at the changes, I'm in a room full of young white guys. But you know, you've got to really think about diversity from a different perspective, because there's a lot of talent out there, and if you're not attracting it, you're the one that's missing out.
Mm. The challenge with diversity goals is always that for every positive step you take, you know, to encourage, you know, some part of our diverse population to join in, there's resentment from the reverse direction that somebody got there because of, you know, that somebody was just trying to make the numbers. It's a curse that cuts both ways. And on one hand, you want to reward the fact that we're being positively increase diversity and have the right viewpoints across the thing. On the other hand, you don't want to see people who aren't qualified or don't have the skills or don't have the capabilities promoted into positions and then drag everything down. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to celebrate diversity in certain ways, and in other ways, I absolutely want to celebrate it at every turn and make sure it happens. And I always just sit there and say, something that's not my pay grade, I don't know how to handle this.
Yeah, the question is this a carrot or a stick? And you really, you have to make it a carrot. You can't make it a stick.
Yeah.
Right. And there are things that can do, there's tons of studies out there about, you know, sort of inherent bias that happens in the hiring process, like a name on a resume. If it's a man's name versus a woman's name, there are studies been done that shows the man's name, even with the same qualifications, he's a higher number of callbacks than a woman. So there are things that can be done, like simple things like, you know, don't have a person's name on the resume or whatever, and just try to change the hiring process so that it's not based on those kind of factors that can have an influence. Let's really make it about what people are capable of. Mm-hmm. All right, we've got some financials to wrap up the show, starting with Cisco. They released quarterly financials and reported revenue of $12.4 billion with net income of $2.3 billion. Cisco beat Wall Street estimates for the quarter, but they still took a little beating after the announcement because they have a weak outlook for the next quarter.
Yeah, Cisco came up with some very mixed results. The key was that probably the headline that you've seen is that Cisco's share prices are down between 3 and 5%. It's been oscillating up and down as people buy and sell based on their perceptions of Cisco's results. Basically, they predicted a 2 to 4% shrinkage into the next quarter. Some people have read that as the world is falling down and it's time to get out of Cisco before everything blows up in a stinking pile. And other people have gone, not so much. It's a grain of salt. Cisco quite often understates its financials, so it always comes in a couple of pennies over what the consensus is. The one that I'm following is George Notter from Jefferies. He says, look, take a grain of salt. The disruption in near-term sales is associated with Cisco's move towards SaaS. So literally, as Cisco sells less and less hardware, we know that's happening because there's no hardware to sell, right? Service providers have stopped purchasing in their capitals. Enterprises have stopped buying million-dollar pairs of Nexus 7000s and going into Nexus 9000s at a fraction of the price. And so Cisco's, but however, is replacing that revenue with software subscription revenue from SD-WAN tools and network monitoring tools, DFA, the switch to the software-driven enterprise routing, and there might even be some revenue from ACI in the middle of all of that. Who knows? And in the service provider space, they lost 12% of sales. So that's a big hit. Service provider business unit is just slightly smaller than the enterprise, so at 12% down. Enterprise was up 5% overall, and the numbers were also muddied a little bit by the sale of the set-top box unit. because that STB business unit, which manufactures set-top boxes, has now been phased out. And so all of the financial transactions and stuff has, and that sort of contributed some stuff. So on the whole, a mixed story. I think it's bad in that Cisco rarely comes in with a weak outlook, although it has done for, had a weak outlook for a couple of years now. But it always seems to come up with the numbers in the long run. So I don't think there's any reason for people to be worried.
Yeah, there was a story on Bloomberg with a quote from Chuck Robbins, who's saying that the weak forecast is because of that drop in switches from telcos and service providers. But he's adamant that that drop isn't because they're losing market share. It's just a slowdown in spending in that market, not that, you know, other competitors are coming in and winning those deals, or maybe even white box driving Cisco out. It's just everybody's slowing down, so nobody panic. We'll be fine.
Yeah, I'm skeptical on the service providers a bit. You know, I was at the AT&T analyst event this summer, and everywhere you turned, everything was about video. Everything was about increasing the bandwidth of the network. Mm. And I'm skeptical. And as I see Juniper stock is going up, and you know, there's more positive outlooks on Juniper, and they're very carrier centric. So as I see Cisco struggling a bit and Juniper doing well, I'm skeptical that the service provider market is as lukewarm as a lot of people are saying it is.
Yeah, I'd agree. I think that the service providers are aggressively looking for ways to cut the traditional buying process. So they want white box. I mean, we saw this month we saw the Open Optical start to get legs. We saw Facebook produce an Open Optical box and then open source that. We've seen AT&T and Verizon be very clear that they are not going to be locked into vendors like they have been in the past in the IP routing space and the LAN switching space, which goes on in their POPs. And we're now starting to see them say the same thing about DWDM. And that's very disruptive to Cisco as well, because Cisco has a very big, very profitable DWDM business, although that's a far more dispersed business. Cisco doesn't have a dominant market share there like it does in the enterprise or the service provider space. On the flip side, however, Cisco's TailF acquisition is absolutely going great guns to them. The VTS, been renamed into VTS, is very popular with customers as a way of producing a multi-vendor strategy across the top based around NetConf and Yang models. I was watching a video this week where Deutsche Telekom were talking about how they're abstraction away the configuration and doing continuous integration, continuous deployment models for their legacy network. So literally modeling the network in Docker containers using TLF and then rolling it out using TLF to the actual physical network. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for every good, there's a bad. So I think, you know, as Cisco's hardware sales drop off, they have to find software sales to come up with those. But open source is waiting there to snap their jaws. So I agree with you, John. There is a risk here that Cisco can miss something and open source would just suddenly gobble up some piece of the business that they were previously betting on. It's not a perfect recovery. I think they're weak in the long run.
I agree.
All right, we also have some news from NetApp. They reported their financials, revenue of $1.34 billion in the quarter with income of $109 million. That's down from this time last year when the company reported $114 million in income. The company is predicting similar revenue for the next financial quarter. On the plus side, the company said its annualized run rate for all flash arrays exceeded $1 billion. Not bad.
And the share price spiked a little bit, spiked $3 because this was better to be expected. However, it's hard to believe that NetApp actually has a future. I still don't know any storage person who says that NetApp is a long-term play for them. So anything that's not bad news for NetApp, I think, is a win.
Yeah, right. Yeah. NetApp was the foil to EMC for a long time. And, you know, now the real foil for EMC is cloud-based storage. And so NetApp is kind of the odd man out in this relationship.
And they missed the SSD. They missed the whole flash thing. They ended up buying SolidFire, of course, but that still gets them very late to the market. they've lost their leadership in that space and sort of foregone it to any number of other competitors. It's hard, and the hyperconvergence continues to eat away at their business as well.
Right. Yeah.
You know, when you just have ordinary off-the-shelf storage coming out of hyperconverged, why would you go to a storage-only company to do business with them in the long run? I find it very difficult to understand how NetApp gets out of the, you know, the sort of the second-to-last position in the market that it's got. I mean, that doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to go broke. It's got lots of incumbents. It's got lots of trailing revenue in service contracts from people with, you know, of all things, spinning Rust still. But, you know, who knows?
Right. Yeah, we'll definitely keep an eye on it. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Network Break. Greg, if folks want to hear more from you, where can they find it?
You can find me on Twitter at Ethereal Mind. At Ethereal Mind. You can find me on packetpushers.net, blogging up the storm this week. Lots of blog posts coming out, and hopefully I should have some videos coming out soon. I'm nearly finished learning how to do YouTubing type style videos, which hopefully will add something to the mix.
All right. I'm Drew Conroy Murray. I'm on Twitter at Drew_CM, and I blog at packetpushers.net. John, if folks want to find you on the internet, where can they get you?
Typically, the best place to find me is Twitter. It's at John, FRUEHE. That's the easiest place, or moreinsightsstrategy.com.
All right. And we'll have a link to John's Twitter handle in our show notes if you want to go check it out. Thank you to our sponsor, Thousand Eyes. And thank you for joining us for this episode of Network Break. If you like the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share it with your friends. And please check out our newsletters. That's Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find out how to sign up for free for those on packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.